Today's interviewee is Yvonne Schoffer, S-C-H-O-F-E-R, who was the American and British Humanities Bibliographer for the General Library System from 1980 to 2008, and then retired and worked a little bit after that, but that doesn't matter. Date is February 27th, 2013.
Okay.
First, Yvonne, we usually start by asking people to provide some background on how they ended up where they are. Life is all preamble.
Well, it's a long story, but I'll try to keep it short. I was born and educated in Nantes, France, and I went to school and to university there, and my lycée background was humanities and classics and all the things that people did in my day. And when I went to university, I started pursuing a degree in English, and this was a three-year course. But in the middle of it, I went to England, as most of us did, to spend a year absorbing the culture, not taking exams or anything. And I ended up staying two, so when I finished my degree, I was about 2 years after where I should have been. Then I applied for a Fulbright student scholarship, and I ended up at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. This was 1965, and I took courses in English. My previous university courses had included literature and language. I also specialized in American literature and linguistics. So I signed up for a master's degree, which turned out to be a good idea because I subsequently married and got into rather difficult visa problems because of the Fulbright Act. But this was eventually resolved, and I obtained a master's degree in 1967. The following year, my spouse was appointed at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and eventually I ended up signing up for a library school, which I did on a part-time basis. Then in 1974, just after having finished my coursework, we moved to Paris for 3 years, during which I worked in a sort of freelance capacity, first at the United States Information Service, which is part of the embassy, the consulate, as a consultant. I did cataloging and reorganization, and then I worked for UNESCO as a Lazard consultant. In those days, all the UNESCO appointments were political, so that all the work had to be redone by outside people, which probably explains why the U.S. pulled out shortly after.
It was that way for Africa, too.
Yes.
The UNESCO histories of Africa were all politically assigned and really bad stuff.
Yes. But it was a good experience for me because I had no practical experience, although I was planning to become a cataloger. And the courses I had taken in library school were really geared to academic libraries, national bibliographies, literature of the humanities, which I'm sure nobody teaches anymore, history of books and printing. So I, at UNESCO, I worked in the department of the division of cultural development, and I reorganized a small clearinghouse and with all sorts of documents. Then I went to the indexing department and was immediately offered a job indexing UNESCO documents. So that continued until we came back to the United States in 1977. I continued doing bibliographies for UNESCO for quite a long time, even at a distance, because our resources here were so much better. There was no professional work available at all in Madison when I came back, so eventually I worked as a half-time library assistant at the Wisconsin Historical Society Library. It was all nuts and bolts, but I learned a great deal that I hadn't learned in library school. I then worked as acting half-time pamphlet cataloguer for about a year, and then eventually the humanities bibliographer position was offered in early 1979. My predecessor Lloyd Griffin had died, I understand, shortly before that, and it was a half-time, 6-month temporary position, and I interviewed, and there was only another applicant, so I was offered the position and started in April 1980. Although my library experience was mostly in cataloging, I was interested in the subject matter, and I felt that I could handle the various components. What I hadn't realized is how much work it meant, because David, you probably know this better than I do, but my predecessor had worn many other hats.
Head of reference department and head of the bibliographers and the English and American humanities.
Plus writing all sorts of grant proposals for the director.
No wonder he died, huh?
No wonder he died, and I understood later on that he did collection development on the fly at home in the evening.
Yeah, I don't doubt that either, yeah. I mean, of course, in those days, there were no approval plans, and it was
one
book at a time.
There was the British blanket order, which worked quite well, and in fact, this was a very good thing for me when I started, because those books came by themselves. We also had, as I discovered later on, a very good Canadian gathering plan, but we did not have any full-scale plans with any of the... We had vendors, but I don't think there was anything...
I don't think so either.
So, I was trained in about half a day by one of my former colleagues. There was a huge amount of help in the... office next door into 78. Had I been able to supervise properly, I might have taken better advantage of it, but as it is, I didn't know the most basic procedures, so that was something that took a fair amount of time. The procedures were exceedingly labor-intensive. Everything was manual in those days. Selections were taken by a full-time employee that searched or had student searchers search everything. Then orders were typed on 3 or 4 slips and went up to acquisitions, which, as far as I can tell, redid the searching entirely on their own files, because there was such a time lag between the order development and typing and the actual ordering. So that was all right. I simply tried to get a grasp of the enormous amount of catalogs and routed journals that came by on my desk every day. And since I had to start somewhere, I had to do them all at first, on a half-time basis. I can honestly say that when I went full-time 3 years later, I don't think I accomplished much more in on a full-time basis than I did.
That's what they say, that two half-time people, for instance, would do out more than one full-time person.
That certainly could be true. In those days, we had monthly bibliographers meetings with the director, and they were the most adversarial meetings off the record, perhaps, because everyone was working independently.
Okay.
Well, see, I didn't understand at first how it worked, but it seemed to me after a while that since there was no one in charge of the bibliographers, everyone sort of did his or her own thing. There was only another woman bibliographer, Suzanne Hodgman. The budget was allocated according what seemed to be a completely
random, adventitious.
Random fashion. Yeah. And those figures seemed to be etched in stone. So people competed for a few dollars and were always suspicious that others were getting more than they were.
Too true.
So I rather dreaded those Wednesday morning meetings where people were up to shake their fists at one another across the table. And of course the director at the time seemed to encourage that sort of divisiveness. So it really was difficult. And then in addition we had numerous budget freezes at about that time. Every so often from Bascom came down an order that we were to stop ordering immediately. But of course in the meantime the orders had to continue to be generated and processed in the same way, except that there was absolutely no chance for many books to be ever ordered owing to the pressure of new materials. So this was something that made my first few months difficult, but I enjoyed the work enormously because it really gave me an opportunity to use my rather general education that I had received. I was not highly specialized, except that most of my degree had to do with English literature and things like philology and history of the language. But then everything else was so interesting, and gradually I realized I was also responsible for a number of other subjects, such as linguistics, which was a really difficult problem. I will talk about it later. Communication arts, mass communications, so that included film, radio, television in English, and cultural media, journalism, and history of the book. The geographical areas involved in my selection responsibilities were the United States and Canada, England and Ireland and Scotland, Australia, New Zealand, and the English-speaking Caribbean area. So quite a wide range of countries. I didn't know anything at all about publishing or the book trade in general, so this was also something I had to try and understand. So after about a year of this, although the 6 month limit had largely been exceeded, I went up to the director and said, well, what's happening now? I understood the position was temporary. And he looked absolutely aghast and pained that I should have thought that. Oh, said, no, just carry on. And this went on.
Tenure just like that?
Just like that, for 3 years. I requested evaluations. But I don't quite remember who conducted them, but I felt I really needed to have some sort of acknowledgement of what I had been doing. Things were going pretty well, except that of all the difficulties with the budget freezes. We had a lot of help in the acquisitions department, and everyone was really quite helpful. So that meant that once I had selected something, I did even have to follow up on it. But I did go to acquisitions every day to see what books had been received. And this is a practice I continued for a long time until we were actually discouraged from doing that when the books were whisked off the shelves fast and efficiently by Central Technical Services. But that was much later. So in addition, after I had been working for, say, 3 weeks, I was told that I was also in charge of 4 special collections in Rare Books. It's in your field, so you get on with it. So there were 2 old archival collections for which there was really no money to buy many additional materials. One was the 20th century collection of first editions, which at the time was in a cage on the second floor, sort of rather open to winds, really, on one side, where we had collected first editions of James Joyce, Hemingway, Faulkner, Virginia Woolf, all for the shelves to be pilfered, as indeed some were. And the collection was based on a list that had been established by jointly between Lloyd Griffin and the English department, but it really was a list of the preferences of faculty members at the time. So there was a lot of writers who had not really fulfilled their initial promise, and others that had not been collected at all because they had been considered too popular or unsuited to an academic collection. And we had some really very valuable editions there, with dust jackets and signatures and dedications. And the American part of the collection was very useful, because people who were working on the dictionary of regional English used it a great deal to verify the first use of certain words in the 20th century works by American writers. And the rest was pretty much used, by me to display at presentations for library school students that were requested quite frequently by Charles Bugge at the time, for still teaching the literature of the humanities. The other one was a collection of private press books, which would have been interesting had there been a budget to sustain it, but there wasn't, so everything had to come out of the general English humanities budget. And it included historical, or shall we say, starting with the works of the great British presses in the late 1980s, through the work of printers and small private press publishers publishing still at the time. But of course, there was no collection policy. It was all pretty much try to get as much as you can. And the private press books were not terribly expensive at the time. I think a few years later, I got a sense that there was a shift in collecting practices among private collectors, so that people couldn't afford to collect art anymore. It was too expensive. So instead, they moved to limited editions and first editions of modern writers. Now, at the same time, our stacks here at Memorial were full of valuable 19th century works, sometimes in original bindings. And there was a huge problem with keeping those in the stacks, because increasingly alert book thieves would figure out they were there.
Was this before the days of tattletaping or after?
Oh, well before. Uh-huh. There was no tattletaping at all.
Yeah.
I don't know when that started. Probably mid...
I think it was still like Joe Trazen still here.
Well,
but of course it wasn't.
Perhaps, but they didn't...
It was every third
they
book
only
or something
table
like that.
Tattletape the books that were borrowed on return. So I'm sure we still have them on the second floor. In the I think all the 18th century books were eventually moved, but that was also a huge amount of work.
So you went through the stacks and the records of columns
over the years, but then rare books sometimes had no room to have them, or in some cases was the present curator was quite reluctant to accommodate a lot of things. So, looking back, this is one of the things I wish I had been able to do more efficiently and more in a more structured manner, with the help of rare book staff.
So you think there's still remnant copies of the 1850s?
Well, when I retired, I had lists of things that I felt should be transferred. Leather bindings, things like that. Well, who knows? I did manage to get the 20th century collection transferred to Rare Books, which was still in a very small space on the fourth floor. And this was done manually. There were about 8,000 books in that collection. And they had to be brought up a little flight of stairs. I don't know if you remember it in the Rare Book stacks.
Yeah, up to the stairs.
So there was a sort of chain of people passing the books. So that was at least safe, at least from casual pilfering. And the other two collections, on the other hand, were active.
There being the Cairns and what's
the Cairns and one? Little Magazines.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay.
Little Magazines was sort of ongoing because it had been established much earlier by Felix Pollock in the, I guess, in the 60s.
Was the curator of Rare Books in the 60s and 70s.
Yes, yeah. That's right. So he had found an extensive collection of small literary journals owned by a Dr. Sukov from Minneapolis, and had bought the entire collection for the library. Being a poet himself, he was interested in this type of publications because a lot of poetry appeared in those journals. And we included, there were American titles as well as British titles because, of course, that tradition started probably earlier. I was talking about the Little Magazine collection?
Yeah.
Yes. So we had some important late 19th century English journals that had also been collected by Dr. Sukov, which were sort of valuable and rare even then. And Dr. Sukov had proceeded to continue collecting English and sometimes Australian journals. It really was an interesting collection. But in those days, the physical object was not an object of great respect. So he had all those journals bound very tightly between hard covers, which meant that sometimes you had to go like this to even get to the left-hand side margin. And a lot of advertising material had been removed as well, which is a practice that was discontinued, I think, shortly after we acquired the collection, because nothing else was bound after the Sukov collection.
So this is the fact that it's commercial value, but now it's intellectual value.
Well, yes. But the American publications, of course, I don't know how much Felix bought right away after the Sukov books. But he went to such lengths to find, and of course he was so well connected with that sort of publication that he managed to collect some pretty, very, very rare newsletters, for instance. There's one newsletter edited by Amiri Baraka, Leroy Jones, as was, in the early 60s that probably doesn't exist anymore anywhere else because it was mailed to individuals. So that we have in a file folder, but that was then published as a, what's the word I'm looking for?
Not sure.
A reprint.
Yeah.
So that, which was good, we bought that as well because the originals sort of falling apart. So when people want to use those, now they need a pretty good reason for...
You mean to see the originals?
The originals have stamps and addresses.
Yeah, right,
of,
yeah.
So there is an... artifactual value to them, but the reprint, of course, for textual values. So that collection has been active since the early 1960s, which means that it's a very good collection. When I retired, we had about 12,000 titles, including maybe probably less than 1,500 active titles. Because for most of those publications, the lifespan was extremely short. The average was seven issues.
Are they still collecting them?
Oh, yes, yes. But it was cheap, so that there was a separate line on the budget, which was never increased very much in spite of repeated attempts. If I had been Jim Dankey, I would have spent my time trying to get them for free, as he did with his publications at the Historical Society, but there was no time for that. But most of the processing was done by the rare book staff, and they were very, very knowledgeable. So that was not something I had to worry about. So issues were collected and kept in boxes rather than in between bound covers. And they now occupy about half of one of the vaults in special collections in the present location. So it's a growing collection. It's over time, I think it changed because the technology changed so much. So instead of being mimeographed and typed by people who didn't know how to type, they now are very sort of slick and glossy, which in a way detracts from their objective, which is to be countercultural and experimental.
No doubt raises the price of them too.
Well, yes and no. A lot of them are now supported by institutions, which also detracts from the countercultural purpose. But every so often, something very original comes along. And I didn't do much selection work for those because those publications tend to be very self-referential, so that they would, when you looked at the most recent issue, it gave you titles of other similar publications because they circulated among a very restricted number of readers. I think the audience for poetry, I don't know what it's like now, but it's rather small. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, the rare book people could easily order sample issues of everything new that came along. That's how we kept going. Of course, the little magazine collection was absolutely hated by the acquisitions department and the serial people because they tend to be irregular. They tend to move. If the editor moves, the publication goes with. And their billing practices are extremely haphazard, so not a favorite of a lot of people. So at times it was clear that no one was going to do any claiming. Therefore, the Special Collections staff, well, Barbara Richards, has been doing all the claiming for years because it was not well done in the serials acquisition, especially since the computer does not really want to deal with publications of that nature. But a very popular collection, used absolutely at the top of the list of statistics of special collections, probably even to this day, because in Madison, of course, a lot of people are interested in that sort of literature. But the other special collection, the one that really started with, was not conceived by me, but was developed by me, was the Cairns Collection of American Women Writers, which had been was funded by a very generous bequest to the university and to the English department by Professor William Cairns, who had been at the turn of the century, a pioneer in the promotion of American literature. Until the early 1900s, English literature was taught in English departments, and certainly no modern literature, but 18th and 19th century, and before that, of course, Shakespeare and Chaucer. But he had written several books about 19th century American literature and started teaching it, which was very unusual at the time. I think Wisconsin was one of the first places where this happened. And he left in his will a considerable amount of money to the English department, to the university, of course, and the English department decided that it would be used to develop a collection of women writers who, it was felt, had been rather neglected in academic libraries, because most of what was written up to until 1900 was popular fiction or poetry, and therefore deemed unsuitable for academic research. It was not quite true. I found that we had things in the stacks that I ended up transferring to the Cairns collection eventually, particularly in Cutter. So there were things that had been either given to the library or acquired by... Lloyd Griffin was very alert to this sort of thing. So there was a committee that had decided to spend the money on a collection of that sort, although I think the original bequest only said exceptional resources in American literature, but this was earmarked for a collection of women writers, initially stopping at 1900, which was an extremely arbitrary date, the assumption being that after 1900 more women would have been collected in university libraries, which was not always the case, because there was still a strong bias against anything that could be a little bit popular, for instance. To give you an example, Zona Gale, who was a local, a Wisconsin writer, had left all her papers and books to the Historical Society. They kept all the papers, all her manuscripts and so on, but they gave us the books, and they were languishing in the basement. In remember that big room where we had things that collections that hadn't been dealt with?
Yeah.
Well, you know the one.
Yeah.
Became a sort
of... B-124.
Yes. And all of Zona Gale's books were there. All of Edna Ferber's books were there. And they had both... Edna Ferber had been hugely popular and translated in every language on the planet. And all those books were in the basement. So...
Unrecorded anyplace?
No, we didn't even have temp slips for those. No. Oh, then there was control in addition, where things had not been processed. But initially, that's not what I was supposed to do. I was supposed to start ordering materials for some pretty major writers and others. Of course, others was a totally uncharted territory, because no one knew how many women writers we were going to come up with. And in fact, there was a thought, probably as well in the English department, that we could easily muster a list that then we would proceed to develop. So the people in special collections had started writing, preparing little biographical folders. It was pathetic. When you realize that most of the women who wrote from the early 18th century on there was no biographical information whatsoever at the time.
A lot of them wrote under men's names, didn't they?
Well, some did, yes. There were a lot of subterfuge of that nature. So it was a completely blank state in a way. Some books had been donated. Lloyd had probably identified some good collections. There was a collection of Emily Dickinson first editions that had been bought by a professor at Northwestern. But he was working quite closely with two faculty members in the English department who were very good at finding this sort of material. Bill Gibson, I don't know if you knew him. And then Walter Rideout.
I know the name.
Yes. So they were very helpful, but of course they had no idea of library procedures. So they had gone ahead and bought a few books themselves without searching the catalogue to see if we already had them. Because clearly there was going to be a certain amount of transfers that needed to be made. So in those days we were still receiving a lot of out-of-print catalogues, although I understand nothing much had been bought by in the way of antiquarian materials by the library by that time. But starting with those, it was fairly easy to identify the dealers that specialized in such materials. And of course at the time there was not a lot of demand. This happened to coincide or to be a result of the establishment of the Women's Studies program on the Madison campus, so that it was really early days for any active interest to have been developed of those materials, which really was a great help to me, because we were able to get some very, very rare titles for very little money. To give you an example, Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who was a feminist writer of the early 20th century, had started writing before the 20th century, wrote a very short book called The Yellow Wallpaper, about 100 pages. I was able to find a copy of that in relatively good shape, a very fragile book, for $35. 10 years later, it would have cost $3,500 to buy that book, and of course there weren't many in existence. So with the help of some very knowledgeable dealers, and of course the word spread that we were interested in women's work, so that I ended up getting a lot of catalogues. But it almost became a priority, because they had to be searched immediately and reserved by letter. In those days, mm-hmm. the library did not want you to use the telephone to call the dealers and to make your out-of-state calls. So it was labor-intensive in many ways, and we ended up losing things that we wanted. But I had extremely good help for that in the bibliographer's office. There was a half-time position that dealt exclusively with special collections. Michael Cohen was one of them. A number of other people, but there have been so many I can hardly remember. Mm-hmm. And then Carlene Rohde ended up in charge of that, even when she was forced to leave her half-time job in our office. So those people were really very, very helpful and contributed to the success of the collection. But to go back to the collection itself, in their wisdom, the English department had made up a list of nine canonical American women writers. So for those, the collecting policy, such as it was, because there was nothing in writing, was to order everything, first editions, manuscripts, letters, everything we could find. And then for others, anything, preferably first editions, if we could find them. But it was clear it was not going to remedy the basic problem, which is that authors that had not been successful in their time were not going to be so heavily connected. So this policy, which I eventually wrote several years later, was that we would collect everything for everybody, because in the case of unknown or lesser known writers, it was more important for us to acquire materials that shed light on their work, critical materials, letters and manuscripts, especially since for the canonical writers, Emily Dickinson, Harriet Beecher Stowe, everything was already collected by other libraries, certainly in terms of manuscripts. But we had a very generous budget. It fluctuated somewhat, but so that's because it was poorly administered by the Board of Regents, not by there was an office in Peterson. That was the Board of Regents. So there were times when we had sharp drops, unrelated to the fluctuations of the market, and that had to be worked on as well eventually. But that collection attracted a lot of attention, and a lot of people started using it, and faculty members started talking to their classes about it. There was a committee that met twice a year, I suppose it still does, made up of librarians. The Women's Studies librarian was ex officio on it. Me and on the faculty side, two or three people. I think Mr. Trace was present at the early meetings.
He was the director until 1982.
Yes. 1982, yes. So that there would be a report on acquisitions and a list of things that had been purchased and a budget report. So that happened every year for as many years I was in charge. I believe now the faculty representation has been increased to include people from history. Because that's the other thing about this collection. It started out as a literary collection, and it became clear fairly rapidly that women, how far back, it's not possible to go very far back, really, because there's so little extent, had been writing for money rather than anything else, so that the type of materials that they tended to produce were fiction, best-selling fiction, which was certainly the case in the late 19th century, but also anything that could sell, cookbooks, children's books, and then things on education and religion and self-help, a huge range of unliterary topics, but they had to be collected as well, because authors typically had produced a range of material covering both fiction, poetry, and drama, and these other fields which were more lucrative in a way. There was, of course, it was a retrospective, so try to find 18th century materials, and I found quite a few in Qatar, which was good, not in very good condition, but still apt to be transferred. We tried to aim.
Qatar was an early classification that was used until the 50s and then replaced by the Dewey Decimal System and finally by the Library of Congress.
That's right. And the Historical Society still had Qatar when I was working there. They were slowly converting it to LC. But in a way, that's how they had been protected, because I'm not sure the Qatar cataloging was very extensive.
Difficult to find anything in Qatar, even if it was done right.
There probably was just an author entry in the title in some cases. So books were transferred, and others were bought. So that was a very fast developing collection. I think in the first year we ordered perhaps 1,000 books, and then it just went on as more and more vendors realized what we were after. We got more and more offers. That's the way it goes. At the same time, I was looking for reference materials, both for the general collection and to be duplicated as a little reference collection in rare books. And because of the developing interest in women's studies, a lot of very good bibliographies were being developed. So that was a help as well. Let's see. There's so much to say about that collection. It's very hard to stay on any particular track. Eventually, the Department of Special Collection moved to its present location on the ninth floor, but that didn't happen until the early 90s, the late 80s.
Sounds right.
So that there was more space, I think we were able to do more with more general materials at that point. And I don't know how many titles there are now. When I retired, we had close to 11,000 books. But of course, as years went by, materials became more scarce, the demand increased from other places and private collectors. So the early years were really a good time to develop that collection in its basic form, both by acquiring printed books and manuscripts, photographs, anything we could find. We have some magic lantern slides. One of our most heavily collected authors is Harriet Beecher Stowe. So that is a huge amount of material, because of course her book Uncle Tom's Cabin was published in every possible language, completely outside of copyright in many cases. She also wrote other books. A lot of books were written about her. She contributed to periodicals, and there were lots of artifacts, playbills for stage representations of Uncle Tom's Cabin, music scores, magic lantern slides, locks of hair, photographs. So we have all that in special collections. And for Harriet Beecher Stowe, we were particularly fortunate to buy at least two private collections of successive editions of the books. And since these had been private collections, they were in very, very good shape. And then eventually, in the mid-1990s, Blackwell's of Oxford, England, called me up one day to say there is going to be a wonderful collection of Harriet Beecher Stowe coming up at auction at Christie's or Sotheby's, I think. And are you interested? And I said, yes, we would be very interested. What are these books? And they were all the pirated British editions of Uncle Tom's Cabin, which amazingly were published by 28 different publishers in the UK the same year as it was published in this country, 1852. So all those publishers were, there were no copyright agreements whatsoever, so they all took the book and did things with it. And a private collector in the UK had assembled all those editions, which in many cases were cheap and easily disposable. There were lots of things, very small books that people would carry in their pockets. They had slightly changed the title to make it look as though it was not the same book, and issued many, many different variants and printings. So altogether, 120 extremely rare publications. There were also some supporting materials, fairly rare. Mrs. Harriet Beecher Stowe was embroiled in the Byron fight between George Byron, the poet, and his wife. And of course there was a huge scandal in England because he was found to have had an incestuous relationship with his half-sister. So opinion was divided, and Harriet took the part of the wronged wife and wrote copiously about the subject. So there was a lot of periodical publication at the time about that, and this was all collected in an extremely rare book. Anyway, a wonderful collection. I put in a bid. Blackwell was going to use work as our agent. And the day before the auction, it was quite late at night, and I thought, my bid is too low, we're not going to get it. So I got up and had another bid faxed, adding a few thousand dollars to my original bid, and it was just as well because we got it, but there was another institution after it. So my second bid was timely. So this was a very, very nice addition to the collections, although it hasn't been processed as far as I can tell. And we also got a complete descriptive bibliography of those books that had been established by the original collector. And that is one of the things that I regret the most about having retired, is that I was never able to get it transcribed and published on the library website. There was opposition reluctance, shall we say, in the Red Book, the Special Collections Department.
How were they?
It's two big folders of typed manuscript, of complete bibliographic, very good, about the books that we bought for our collection.
And their objections were what?
Yes, we're going to do that later, but we don't have enough student help. I'll think about it and I'll get back to you, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It would have been possible to get it, everything would have had to be rekeyed because it was typed, and the man who had developed that bibliography had added little pieces of paper here and there, so they would have everything and hand annotations, so it would have been had to be completely reformatted in order to be digitized, and no one was willing to by that time I was already half retired, so there was nothing much I could do to get them to pay any attention to it.
So the 140 books or whatever the number was,
the books we have, and they
but they're inaccessible, right?
Well, I think Susan Stravinsky has been cataloging them, so they are in the catalogue. I'm not sure she's done, but all the bibliographic information about those things that tend to be variant printings, variant issues with annotations, all this is in two big typed folders. And if only we could have had, enough help and incentive to do something with it, it would be an extremely valuable bibliographic tool.
Pretty indispensable if the books are going to be used themselves, and they're probably used with full knowledge of, or as much knowledge as we could have.
Yes, but you see, no one has access to this information too at the moment. In fact, a French woman wrote to me who some years ago preparing a very extensive book on foreign editions of Harriet Beecher Stowe, and she had heard we had the collection and wondered if we could send her copy of title pages and the like. I said, no, we can't do that. We haven't even processed the bibliography. So she published her book and it doesn't have the British editions in it.
Yeah.
But the digital technology group had a list of projects at the time. So it would have been at the bottom of the list, I think, because we would have had to prepare the material for digitizing, and there was just no help for that, and I couldn't request student help, or the curator felt that First of all, they would have to train the student, which is ridiculous, so they never get the time to believe. So nothing has happened to it, and the two folders are still in Susan Stravinsky's office.
You hope?
I hope. I'm not sure. I mean, it's not my place now to do anything about it.
Sad.
Yes, it's a pity. In any event, this is a collection that has given me a lot of satisfaction. and I've been helped by very good people in acquisitions. I have to say that Carlene and Sylvia Adrian really worked very hard on these two collections. Carlene did a ton of authority work, which meant that she and I were able to develop an index to a variant form of authors' names, because, as you said, sometimes women authors took on men's names and a lot of pseudonyms, and in addition, people had lots of names in the 19th century. So the order of their names changed according to various reference sources. Mm-hmm. So we established an index by which the authority form was the main form of entry, but all variant forms could have a system of C also, or C references to access the name under which those books or materials were catalogued in our catalogue. And another notable development was that earlier than that, I was able to get the first book by an American woman writer, Anne Bradstreet's The Tenth Muse, published in 1620? Well, anyway, very early on. And no other copy had come up at auction since 1949. And that I got from what's the name of that dealer in London? Blank. Anyway, I put money together to buy that. Even our budget would not be adequate to pay for it, or what was left of it at the time of the purchase. It cost $25,000. And it's a little book in its original cover that had belonged to an American collector. And it has the improbable title of The Tenth Muse, lately sprung up in America. Anne Bradstreet wrote a lot of poetry, some of it very didactic. She was a British woman who came with her family out of Boston Spa. I even went there in Lincolnshire to see her birthplace. They consider her an English writer there.
Born there.
Her father was governor of Massachusetts, and then she married the next governor of Massachusetts. She had 8 children who all survived, and this book was published unbeknownst to her in I think it's 1650 in England by her brother-in-law, and at the beginning of the book there are about 15-20 pages of various encomia saying, well, yes, she wrote those poems, but she only wrote them in her spare time, so that she had not failed in her normal domestic duties. Mm. And it was very successful, and we were able to get the second edition later on, and she had revised that and added more personal poems. The other great find was that we also owned in rare books, but not in the collection, the first book by an African American woman, Phyllis Wheatley. So we had the first appearance of her poem in an anthology published in the 18th century. No particular information about her in that publication, but then we also have the first printed copy of her poems with a frontispiece portrait. So that was already owned. I think it probably came from that big collection that was bought for the rare books. That man who had it all on Rock Island of Washington.
Yeah, Thordarson.
Thordarson collected all over the place. So it's possible that they came from that because he collected in every subject, or at least he bought in every subject. Would we have to stop?